If you are a fan of the Dive Bar Rockstar podcast and would like to help support the show, there's a great way that you can do that and start a new fashion trend. We have a new merchandise page on the website, which features t-shirts and hoodies that are available for sale on Amazon. Just click on merchandise in the top menu and all of the links will be there, or go directly to divebarrockstar.com/merchandise. Get started early on your Christmas shopping at divebarrockstar.com. Welcome to the Dive Bar Rockstar Podcast, a show exploring the lives of professional musicians of all types, touring musicians, recording artists, songwriters, engineers, bar bands, wedding bands, and anyone making their living in the music industry. Whether you've dreamed of being a professional or you already are one, this is the podcast for you. I'm your host, Eric Baines, and I hope that you not only find some entertainment here, but also some helpful tips, trade secrets, and ideas that will help you achieve your dreams. I'm going to get right to the guests today because we broke the record, the Dive Bar Rockstar podcast record, for longest interview time. We talked for over 2.5 hours, but we had a great time doing it, and we're musicians without a gig. So what else are we going to do? He is currently the guitarist for Dwight Yoakam. And so we have spent many hours hanging out on the road, yet still seem to find hours of stuff to talk about, which is a really great thing when you're on the road all of the time, you know, with somebody. He's toured and recorded with Dwight for the last 6 years, but before that, he toured with the famous 50s throwback act from the 70s and 80s, Sha Na Na. He also had his own band, and we'll talk a bit about his new album, which was released this week, called A Week of Sundays. He's a great guitar player and a really fun guy, so please enjoy my conversation with Eugene Edwards. Dive Bar Rockstar. You grew up in the wee town of Yuma, Arizona.
I guess it was pretty small, yeah. Well, compared to LA, it is. In my memory, it was really small, and not a lot to do.
Yeah,
play sports or play guitar. Mm-hmm. And looking back, though, it was an interesting place because of the Marine Corps has its largest air base there.
Oh, interesting.
And my father worked out there at the air base. He was a civilian, but he worked there. But because of that military, there was a lot of that was where the diversity was going to mostly come from, right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's a border town, so you had a lot of the migrant workers were there. So obviously, there's you know a lot of northern Mexico is coming through, you know, back and forth. And and then in the winter, we would get what we call the snowbirds. You know about this?
These are older
or retired people from northern states or from Canada, and they all flock down over the winter months
because it's
still like 89 degrees in January.
Right.
It's easier on their bones. It's more comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they would just double the population of the town. And it was great for the economy. They would come in and just, you know, restaurants would, I'm sure they just depended on those 3 months alone to keep them afloat. Because by August, it's like an atom bomb has gone off.
Right,
it's like 113 average.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
That's just the reality of it. And to this day, here in LA, I still make a good habit of not complaining about the heat.
Right.
Because all I have to do is call my mom and say, hey, what's the weather over there?
Yeah, exactly.
And second question, why are you still there? I've wanted to get out of there so badly, man.
Oh, I totally understand.
Here's the curse, though, because Yuma, Arizona is it's like a 5-hour drive from here.
Mm-hmm.
If you're driving cautiously.
Okay.
Like if you really, you know.
Mm-hmm. What's the fastest you've made it?
10 hours, because I don't look forward to going there. So it's just to invert the question a bit. No, I could probably do it like 4 or 4.5 if you're really booking.
Right.
But we got on the television, we got KTLA Channel 5
here,
and KCAL 9.
Wow.
We got these two local LA affiliate stations.
Whoa.
And you'd see these local ads for really fun things to do that were not in your town. It was just to watch my Dick Van Dyke reruns was also an experience in watching ads for, well, this is back when Marine World was still up. And for all, you know, SeaWorld and Disneyland and Six Flags and all that.
Yeah.
And then you just kind of look out the window and there's just dust,
desert,
and cactus.
Right.
And oh my God, what are we doing here? Man. So then, by the time I graduated high school, I'd already been accepted to Berkeley.
Hmm.
And there were other music. So I could have just even gone to a state university and studied music, but that mm-hmm. one was, that was really like the furthest I could get from the UMA geographically.
And weather-wise as well.
It was a shift. It was a shift.
Did you even, you probably didn't even have a coat.
I did. I went to a thrift store in Yuma and got a wool pea coat, a navy pea coat. And the the woman who owned the thrift store, her son was a Berkeley graduate, of all things.
That's cool.
Pete Pancrazzi, yeah. And so that was, she's, because she asked, she goes, why are you buying this? Because I'm moving to Boston. Goes, right. Oh, you know, and then the conversation goes from there.
Right.
But Berkeley was, you know, and I was only there for a semester. As they say, it's easy to get in, but it's hard to graduate.
Right.
But that was and as most of your guests have said, it was, it was really just, you learned so much more from your peers.
Yes.
Your students, you know.
Well, especially in a semester.
I actually did, really. I mean, because, but the problem is I wasn't really a jazz head.
Right.
I could do it enough to get by in ensembles.
Right.
I had already been playing a lot of country in bars at that point.
Gotcha.
So how to swing was not a problem.
And was that kind of the main music in Yuma? What are you surrounded by in Yuma?
At that time, it was just...
I mean, Van Halen's probably around.
Well, yeah, there was a lot that of, there like was it, a lot of basic rock and a lot of, you know, like kind of not Norteño music. Technically, but a lot of the Tex-Mex style stuff.
Right.
If you wanted a gig, there was that or country. And there was just, but there wasn't like tons of avenues to play live music.
Right.
I had some buddies who'd all gone the punk route and they had band names that I can't even say on your show, honestly. but my various complexes didn't really suit that music.
Right.
Right.
You know? Right. Right.
And I wanted to be a little more melodic and I guess technically adept than what they were into doing. So the one band that really had the great house gig in Yuma at the time was a band called Fast Gun. And, so I kind of got folded into that the summer. I was already going to go on to Berkeley. I just kind of went in to fill in, as a guitar player, before I went off to Berkeley thinking I'd never return.
Right.
And then, following year, guess what? I'm returning. And they said, well, guess what? We haven't replaced you yet. So if you need a gig, which I desperately did.
Right.
And then I was with them for, and right around that time, they were going to start hitting the road, you know, and playing at the time, this was in the early 90s. So it was like the line dance circuit, which was an interesting circuit because you would go in, I got used to, you had to travel with your own PA.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be this totally self-contained unit. And you'd go in and you'd play five nights, four nights a week. You know, that was a stand there. And you know, yeah, playing five sets. So there was a place in Albuquerque, I think it's called the Sundance Saloon. And on Saturdays, you had to play seven sets.
Oh my gosh.
They said, good, but you're allowed to repeat sets one and two later if you want.
So you just start over.
Oh, may we?
Yeah, please. Oh man. But those nights paid half as much.
it was a weird way. And also the thing about that though, a band like that and gigging like that is that you don't get to see other bands.
Right.
You don't meet other musicians. Mm-hmm. So it was a very insular world, which is fine for me because I was the youngest. Everyone was about 10 years older than me.
Right.
So I still had this family protective cocoon, which I thought Berkeley was going to provide that.
Right.
It turns out that the band Fast Gun did. And I learned how to gig. And you get the 10,000 hours.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
And this is where I really got to. Well, I was already familiar with all the Dwight stuff because I just learned those records when they came out from the first one because my dad brought the first one and I just thought this is just outstanding and I want to make that sound. We covered, I mean, there were certain bands, certain country artists at the time that we had to cover. Well, we had to cover a lot and there were a few like we would genuinely get excited when, oh, hey, Dwight's coming out with a new record.
Right.
I was like, oh, that's great because that's at least 3 to 5 songs we know we will like
playing. Right. Yeah.
Rodney Crowell was one of them. The Mavericks was another. Steve Earle for sure. Now we were doing Copperhead Road before it was a line dance.
Wow.
It was a weird song to do. And I told Steve, was it last summer, 2 summers ago? We did the
We did the LSD tour. Lucinda, Steve Earle, and Dwight.
Yeah. So that was a great experience. And then the band was starting to slow down a little bit. And I'd kind of fallen into the rockabilly scene in San Diego.
Oh.
Thankfully, Fast Gun started playing San Diego a lot. And I kind of just moved there.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and that's kind of the big city from where you were.
Yeah.
Like it's closer than LA and
yeah. Phoenix and San Diego are equidistant.
Gotcha.
In different directions. I certainly didn't want to move to Phoenix.
yeah.
It was kind of more of the same.
Well, if those are the two you get to pick from, that's
right?
It's not really, I mean, Phoenix is fine for what it is. It's great. It's a great place. But San Diego is, it's just gorgeous. And it's 75 degrees all year long. And
it was so
by
nice.
The ocean. And
it was great. And then there was, and maybe around that, there was a band called Hot Rod Lincoln that was there. And I buddied up with them. And there was a whole swing dance situation, rockabilly swing dance thing that was going on. And it was the first time I really had spent, I would spend a lot of time with people my age, for one thing.
Interesting.
There would be a couple of years on me, but not so much. And not as much as the Fast Gun group. So that was interesting as well, that it was the first time I socially kind of felt like, oh, these, you know, I guess we're all kind of catching the same references here.
Yeah,
and
cool.
And we're also kind of as directionless as the guy to the left of you, and it's not an unhealthy thing. It's just this is the natural part of not knowing what you're going to do tomorrow.
Yeah. No, I went through the same thing because that was kind of my rule of thumb anyways, because I wanted to work. So I'm like, I got to work with older guys that have houses.
Sure.
You know what I mean? People who need to work, you know, and you know, in my 20s, that means I'm hanging out with people twice my age all the time. And, and you know, it's cool.
It has its value. No, it definitely has its value.
I definitely felt disconnected from people my age until I got into my 30s and got a gig with people my age, much like you're kind of describing.
A lot of the states where we played when I was still in Fast Gun, because I was still under 21, and I was not allowed to leave the stage on breaks.
Oh, wow. Yes.
So how much more socially awkward could I possibly be? We got an idea.
Oh,
you
man.
Have to stay here
right.
with the lights still on. And I would, I'd bring a book. I'm like reading like Flannery O'Connor short stories, and people are kind of looking at like, what's the deal with this guy?
And every state's different about that. Cause I was 19 when I started.
Right. No, I said only some of the states.
I could be around, but I had to steer clear of the bar, you know, obviously could drink.
Well,
I
was a teetotaler at the time too. So,
yeah, me too.
So fortunately that wasn't, you know, I wasn't really I wasn't going to threaten the livelihood of the band by doing something stupid like that. But it was kind of a, wow, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
And then it was like, it's time to start the third set. I was like, thank God.
I know.
So really looking forward to just playing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I didn't really, because I was a teetotaler, I didn't really appreciate drunks. So I would much rather be playing. Like, I don't need a break. Let's just keep going at it. Cause now I'm looking at a sea of drunk people and I can't drink. And just to get to the bathroom sometimes is like, you know, wading through people and just keep playing?
Why aren't any of you as witty as the people in Cheers? There's not a single one of you that's cracked a joke nearly as half as good as one of Norm's lines.
Exactly.
What's wrong with you guys?
What are you drinking? It's not the right
You're
stuff.
You're drinking the wrong stuff. I have really fond memories of all. I mean, there were kind of low times, but not nearly as many as, because just getting to play. When I went to Berkeley, that was the thing. When I went to Berkeley, I turned 18, I think, when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other students who just couldn't believe that I'd left a paying gig.
Yeah.
And I thought, are you kidding me?
Right.
And they wanted, I was like, so I'm just like, what's it like?
Yeah.
You know, to be on stage. You ever break a string during a song?
Oh, that's so interesting.
Like, is this really, maybe I've done this backwards. I was not a jazz guy, but I was, when I went to Berkeley, I'm working backwards again. At Berkeley, I was so enamored with like Elvis Costello and Squeeze and that sort of pop songwriting where it was still very guitar oriented. There was still some roots music, you know, mixed in there, but I was so into that and really clever wordplay and all those things. And there was at that time at Berkeley, there wasn't really, now there's probably several paths.
Yeah, there's probably Elvis ensemble, Elvis Costello ensemble, and Elvis Presley ensemble.
Yeah, I'm ready for both. So I was kind of a bit of a square peg in a round hole. I mean, I was a performance major, but after a while I was like, I don't know how much of this I want to really perform.
Right. Yeah.
You know, transcribing Charlie Christian solos while I now understand the value of it.
Right.
But at the time I was like, God, it's just, I couldn't have really poured my 18-year-old energy into that nearly as much.
Yeah. But that was kind of me about rock, actually. I remember when you get there, you have to choose, you take history of rock or history of jazz. And I'm just like, I could write the history of rock class. You know, like,
I took history of jazz.
Yeah.
I want to learn.
Do I want to spend my money and study, you know, this stuff that I was.
Exactly.
But I was a jazzer. So I was like kind of the opposite.
I considered the history of jazz was going to be an easy A.
Oh, man.
As well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, interesting. I could take a lecture. I could take notes.
Yeah.
And I wanted to learn this stuff. We didn't have Ken Burns.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So I enjoyed the history of jazz.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I loved it too. Know? Yeah. But it was interesting. But it was very jazzer or rocker because I was there. Well,
I was there in fall of 91 and you.
Oh, yeah.
So we were right afterwards.
Yeah. I got there the winter of 91.
I think a lot of your guests and a lot of your listeners probably have experiences with Berkeley. But I remember when I was there, the really big argument was, were you know, traditional jazz or new jazz? That was the hard line. Yeah. And if you were into rock and, you know, there's a lot of guys there who were into Rush and those technically proficient rock bands.
Yeah,
and it was like, oh, that's cool, man. They know, and like the jazz guys were like, they were fine with that, but they weren't going to really get into it with you because it's like, it's a completely different planet.
Yeah.
And I think that the Marcellus brothers and all those young lions, they'd been around for 10 years and their vampire bite had worked. And they sort of forced. And
as far
as I'm concerned, it seems as though we need both, don't we?
Well, it's tough at that age, though, because everyone comes in with their opinions, and it's cool to like this, and it's not cool to like that.
This is in my head because Wynton Marcellus was just on Marin's podcast.
Oh,
and it's great because Wynton's telling stories about when he was 19, 20, 21, and all the old cats that were putting him in his place, and specifically how. So he's telling stories now that humble him.
Uh-huh.
You know, Sarah Vaughan taking him to school and Betty Carter taking him to school and all these old, you know, Herbie, you know, just kind of just cutting him to size.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate he's telling those stories now.
Yeah.
You know, because the only stories we were hearing about him was like, he was jumping up on Miles's bandstand and making, I mean, it was like, he was very aggressive.
Yeah.
Like really aggressive, which at the time I thought made him kind of cool.
Yeah.
Just because jazz, you know, was always represented with like that hunger.
Yeah, exactly. But in retrospect, it's like, and we could probably talk like about jazz forever, but like somebody brought it up to me and I never really thought about it because at the time it didn't seem that way, but Wynton Marcellus kind of stopped jazz from progressing in a way by saying, no, this is jazz. It just stopped everything. And now it became an argument almost. And like,
that's exactly
it divided everything into two, like I'm a traditional guy versus.
That's right.
And the whole point, not necessarily the point, but there should be a progression to, it should be sort of constantly trying to find new avenues and stuff. But it was just so cool up until that point because you have all these eras and it was moving so fast and progressing and progressing and progressing. And now it's like.
But don't all the genres have that argument? We hear that argument in country.
Yeah.
You're going to hear it in rock. Yeah. You're going to hear it in all these facets. And it, I remember hearing when I was in Shawnee, what a name drop.
We're getting there.
It's next on
the list, man.
You know what? I won't tell this anecdote. I'll let you get back to your format.
No, go ahead. So after that, you got into Shawnee.
Well, that's kind of jumping forward, but yeah.
Well,
that gig was cool because that was also a great gig because of what I learned. Mm-hmm. On that, you know, it was my friend Buzz Campbell, who was in that rockabilly band Hot Rod Lincoln in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And he introduced me to Russell Scott, who brought me here to L.A. in 96 until I got here. And then Buzz got the Shawnee gig and then said, hey, I just got this gig, but I'd love to have you as my fill in, you know.
Cool.
I said, sure. So I learned the show and I would do a couple of shows a year to fill in. And then eventually. Of all things, Buzz ended up playing the guitar player for Lee Rocker of the Stray Cats.
Oh, wow.
His dream, about a dream gig.
Right.
So he said, I need you to take the Shawnee gig, take it over. Said, sure. No, great. Cause I love the work.
Mm-hmm.
And Shawnee was great because they understood the stage. Well, actually just everything about being an act, they thought of it more theatrically.
Right.
So they talked about, okay, move downstage, move upstage. There's certain, although they didn't have me do dance moves necessarily, but they did make me aware that, hey, so-and-so singing solo right now, point your neck in his direction. It just draws the audience's eye towards that person there. Mm-hmm. And it's just a stage awareness. And then before I knew it, I was naturally, if the three dancers down, you know, in the band who were moved over to my side of the stage and were in front of me, I would automatically move to the opposite direction up on a riser. Like right. You just change the look of the blocking. If
yeah,
you will.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Exactly. They made me aware of that sort of stuff. And mm-hmm. I really appreciated that.
Yeah.
So, but we did, and we would do these gigs with local symphonies, mm-hmm. right? Because you would do Under the Boardwalk and all right. those classic tunes, and you would have proper orchestration.
Right.
And we would do these, a lot of them, with Marvin Hamlisch as the guest conductor.
Mm-hmm.
So, cool. Yeah, and we would do like week-long things in Pittsburgh, Seattle, and we, mm-hmm. and you'd hang with Marvin for a week.
Yeah, and you'd probably rehearse. And
we would rehearse. Well, you had to rehearse.
It requires time, yeah.
And
yeah.
all that stuff, and yeah. then there'd be downtime. And all my questions with Marvin were about Groucho Marx, because I knew that he'd worked with him. And I just thought, am I ever going to meet anybody who actually spent time with Groucho Marx? Right,
right.
And we had lovely, lovely talks. And, but I remember he was speaking to, it was an afternoon where they had people who subscribed to the seasonal programming at Ben Arroyo Hall in
right,
Seattle.
Right.
And he's got to do his pitch to try and get them to give more money or find more donors. And it reminded me of some of the symposiums I'd heard Winton give, where in this case, Marvin is trying to preserve the health of classical music in this case, or symphonic music, really.
Right.
And unfortunately, he was playing to the audience, but he, you know, denigrated modern music at the time, like whatever the pop music was, you know, he would make fun of whatever the hit, I don't know what the hit record was at the day. And right. I would remember Winton would do that. He would talk about how a lot of pop music was always playing to the lowest common denominator. I remember him right. phrasing it that way.
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
thinking, must you? And I thought, man, but this sounds like the speech of a desperate man. And he's trying to preserve the original swing of jazz music maybe the most original and purely American art form that we have.
Right.
And on one hand, I understand the preciousness of jazz.
Yes.
Especially in American history and has its roots in our culture and in all the other musics.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have to denigrate at the time rap and hip hop like he did?
Right. And that's the thing. It's the bitterness about it that
right.
that is a drag.
And you're not going to bring people over onto your side with that. You're preaching to the choir.
Yes.
You're going to preserve a lot more than just the music. You're going to preserve the ideas of the people who love that music as
right.
well. And that's maybe
right.
not the best way to go.
Yeah.
He doesn't speak that way now, though.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. He originally played in funk bands in
right.
Louisiana. So it's right. not like he was born playing trad jazz in any way.
Right.
I still think he's a fascinating figure and a great spokesman for music and arts in general.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
At that time, it's just an interesting thing to hear someone say. And I guess I kind of thought to myself, I really don't want to ever sound like that. And I think
yeah.
that's what you're careful, I think, on your show with my podcast, which is dormant now. We'll probably start it at the first year. That was kind of the greed rules. Like, let's talk about music, but let's not spend any time criticizing it.
Right.
Or you know, like saying this is crap, this is terrible, blah, blah, blah. Because,
right.
you know, I don't know, who needs someone to add to that noise?
Right. And especially when you get older, it's just, it's so easy to write you off as a grumpy old dude, you know?
Well, yeah. And then, and now everyone, especially like in social media and like in the comment section, it's like, everyone's a grumpy old dude.
Yeah, yeah,
all
yeah.
ages, all
yeah, right.
It's like, that's just
yeah.
where everyone gets their grumpy old dude out. You
yes,
know?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, can we spend some time kind of...
Right.
Going yeah. the other way?
Well, let's talk about Sean and Awesome more, because
okay.
I spent a good portion of the day just watching stuff, you know. And
oh, you have questions.
Well, not necessarily. I just, it was awesome because like I grew up in the 70s and 80s and they were everywhere. And also my dad was a big fan of Happy Days, you know. So
yeah.
it was like, you know, I think America just... and still does has a really hard time giving up, you know, letting go of the 50s, you know
so
what I mean? It was such an inspired.
This is a really interesting thing. When the first kind of rehearsal I had, it wasn't, I just went over to Scott Simon, who's the piano player.
Mm-hmm.
I went over to his house and we just kind of walked through the set with the acoustic guitar and his piano, just kind of walked through the ins and outs and, mm-hmm. you know, this is your cue, blah, blah, blah. It was great. And then we're sitting chatting afterwards. And I said, so you guys played at Woodstock, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did. So it's August of 69.
Yeah.
The 50s had kind of technically ended with Kennedy's assassination and the Beatles on Ed Sullivan,
right?
63 to 64.
Yeah.
So essentially 5 to 6 years later, there's a 50s nostalgia.
Yeah.
Like, what was the,
it's incredible.
I mean,
and they formed in 69. Like, that was one of their first gigs.
They formed in 68.
68. Okay.
So this is his point. They were, you know, undergrads at Columbia.
Right.
There was a, there was like a glee club
mm-hmm.
and they had done a skit for a Christmas formal. And the idea was that these guys, that the glee club would be in their sweaters and doing kind of that four freshman harmonies and that really proper stuff. And then these other guys would come in dressed as greasers and would harass them to sing doo-wop. And of course they don't know how to sing doo-wop. And then the more they harass them and it's almost going to get violent, out of panic, the four glee club members just break into perfect doo-wop. Out of desperation. That's the gag.
Right, right.
And then they would do this skit. They kind of moved this skit to little clubs like Cafe Wa and stuff in the village.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a skit to do. And they would just grab whomever they had. But it worked. And I think it was. And now a guy who eventually came, I think, one of the original managers, but he was just another student there, was probably looking at this stuff from a social political perspective in 68. If we remember our history, I think Columbia University had to shut down because of student riots.
Oh, wow.
So 1968.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Really rough year.
Right. Absolutely.
Donnie York, one of the original, like, guy in that glee club lineup and still in Sha Na Na, still has his report card from Columbia that semester when it says incomplete due to, like, there's a wording on it that pretty much just says there was no school whatsoever.
Right, right.
So yeah, and they're kind of just moving this skit around the rock clubs, and in the spring of 69, one of the guys putting Woodstock together said, "Hey, we're doing this thing that, you know, we got so and so and so and so and that if you can come out and do it, it'll pay $300."
Right,
you know, the check bounced. That's what they say. Right, and they went on right before Hendrix.
Wow.
I mean, they just waited and waited and waited, and you know, they're supposed to go on whatever it was Sunday night, but ended up going on Monday morning.
Right.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
And they decided to take a really aggressive stand. I mean, they would antagonize the hippies.
Yeah.
As part of their whole thing.
Wow.
And then the John Sebastian's manager said, "Hey, you know, can you open for John? John's going out as a solo thing." Mm. He didn't have a lot of gear set up, so you guys can do whatever you want. And so they went on the road and got a deal.
Oh,
but the real
great
stroke of luck is the movie, the Woodstock movie.
Right. Right.
The lore, the story is there was a, because one of the young editors was a New York NYU film student named Martin Scorsese. And we know how much he loves doo-wop. So he wedges in like a minute and 20 seconds of those guys doing it at the hop. Because like, doo-wop, are you kidding me? No one does this anymore. And then the test audiences, one of the few comic relief pieces in Woodstock. So they got their little appearance there.
Right.
They were able to play the rock clubs. I mean, Sha Na Na they're kind of like a Forrest Gump of rock.
Right. Yes.
And so they played for about 5 years. They played the Fillmore, and they have honest to goodness stories of they played with, you know, they shared a bill with Bob Marley. They would share a bill. You name them.
Right.
They did the gig. John Lennon played at Madison Square Garden as a benefit gig. He wears that army fatigue jacket.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So the bill was like Stevie Wonder, Sha Na Na, and John Lennon. They were on those shows.
Yeah.
And I didn't know. I had the video of that thing, and I was on the road with them. I'm up in my hotel room reading an issue of Mojo magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I read this. And so I go down to catering and scream. I said, "Was anybody going to tell me you guys played that gig with John Lennon? I got to find out like this." And they remember that Lenny, the sax player, went outside to, I think, probably get high in the alley with Phil Spector.
Jeez.
And then they couldn't get back in. And then Phil wanted to pull a gun on the guard. And Lenny's they just got the greatest stories.
Wow.
Keith Moon, the famous thing when he took the animal tranquilizers and passed out on at that San Francisco gig, and they got a kid from the audience.
Right,
to like,
right.
Sha Na Na was with Keith Moon in L.A. the two nights or the night before when he scored those drugs.
Oh, wow.
And that was the funny story, was that they had a night off in L.A. It was like, well, we can hang out with Keith Moon, or we've been invited to have dinner at Phil Spector's house.
Jeez.
And at the time, the safe bet was Phil's house.
How times have changed.
so they're great. Wow. I mean, they're just, it's just one story after another. I mean, I could just repeat their stories, but
it's interesting that you said they came from, it seems like they were more actors coming from the like, because everything you watch, it's all really rehearsed. And then I was watching an episode of their show that they had.
The variety show.
Like, from like 77 to 81 or something. Mm-hmm. And they're all completely at ease in a variety show, acting and doing all the stuff.
Really,
and
well, like, John Bauman, or Bowser, I think, mm-hmm. he was a Juilliard. He was an guy. Actor guy. He was a stage guy.
Gotcha.
So they were adding more theatrical guys to the lineup.
Got
they
you.
They played the rock scene, but you know, you're covering stuff, so you don't have original tunes. So you can
right.
So they did, and right when that was burning out, they got the spot in the Grease movie.
Yes. Right.
And then they got the variety show.
Yeah.
And again, to be on television at that time, huge.
Yeah.
I mean, and all of a sudden they were filling basketball arenas. Yeah. You know, they had semis and they were just
right.
And
everything was obsessed with the '50s then, you know, and the,
American,
you know,
yeah, American Graffiti, Love right. American Style, Happy Days. There was just this, and, but I'm saying that guy that was the manager, but you're never going to edit this. that guy who was their kind of their burgeoning manager had mm-hmm. said, looking at the political and social turmoil of 68, 69, says, mm-hmm. we are quickly going to come to a point where this country's going to want to revert.
Right. Yeah.
And that's your ticket.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, well, he nailed it.
Yeah.
You know, and that happens.
Yeah. I just kept thinking, this is about as far as you can take a novelty act. To take something that sort of sticky as far as they took it is just unbelievable. And they're still out there playing today.
And they're always looking for an angle. It was phenomenal. When Bowser left, because that was a thing where, like, the TV show, they pulled the plug on the TV show. Fine. Mm-hmm. Let's go back on the road. We've got all this momentum. And Bowser's, you know, he's an actor. And he's like, oh, I might have a callback.
Right.
I can't just, like, be out in the middle of nowhere and not be able to get back. So they said, okay, cool. We'll split, you know. And they just realized, well, you don't put another tall, thin guy baritone. So, you know, they got, like, they got two women and... You know, you go the other way.
Right.
You go the other way. And then they always have to repackage the show. There's, you know, there's their Christmas show. And then there's their, and even in their sets, it's like, well, here's the surf set. And here's the doo-wop set. And here's the.
And you were, I saw a clip of you singing La Bamba in the show. I mean, you everyone sort of had their moment. That's what struck me too. And is that even in some of the interviews and stuff, like, even the band was sort of, it was a band. It wasn't like five singers in the rhythm section.
Yeah, like, I think they kind of, I think it was like a street gang where mm-hmm. you had to know all the characters.
Right.
And I think they kind of still think of it that way. Like when I joined, I wasn't Eugene or Gene anymore. I was Gino.
Yeah. You had a character name.
Gino.
Yeah.
And then also what I noticed was I'm obviously not an original member. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, but it was like, let me hear you sing a verse of blah, blah, blah song. And if you say, and if you're better than, if you just came across better than that guy.
Right.
You got the spot.
Oh, that's so cool.
Go out there and be good.
Yeah.
That's it. Because no matter what you did, you were not going to overwhelm the name of Sean and Nah. You were just going to make the show better.
Right.
And so, yeah,
brilliant.
And I got the experience of singing Blue Moon with a full orchestra behind me. Or singing Sandy with an orchestra behind me. It's like, wow, this is, when am I ever going to sing with an orchestra?
That's so cool.
And great experiences.
And you're listed on Wikipedia as a band member. That's what struck me,
am
too.
I?
Yeah, it's like, actually, you're still listed as a current band member. So, well, I don't think they've updated it in a minute, but...
Shut enough. What's there to update?
But it's really, it's an interesting page because it's everyone's band members and the history of all the band members. And it's not, so I don't know. And it obviously kind of felt sort of like that.
I'm proud. It really was the first thing of, like, I'm in show business now. Like, there's old naked men backstage now,
and there's
props, and there's all, and just again the nomenclature of it, you know, was so exciting to me, really.
You know, absolutely,
I loved it.
So how did you get from there to now you are the guitar player for Dwight Yoakam? That's how we know each other.
Oh man, okay, so all that time that I was with Sean and I, we're talking about in the early 2000s,
mm-hmm.
I'd also had tried my hand at, I was kind of also had my own solo career, right? Original, had my own band and had original tunes and was taking a crack at that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was juggling a lot of stuff. God, I was doing the K-Earth morning show. I was doing a bit there every weekday morning.
That's cool.
And then I was working with my friend, Tim Jones, who's a film composer, a lot of network television and film stuff. And so I'd be at his studio at night, wake up in the morning, do the morning show. And then on the weekends, I'd be either on the road with Sean and Nah or playing with my band or playing at Disneyland with a friend of mine
mm-hmm.
who did an old Elvis gig.
Right.
Just juggling. And Brian Whelan was a guy who who I'd met. He walked into this club in Culver City called the Cinema Bar. My mm-hmm. band was playing, and he and a bunch of his buddies walked in, and they hung out, and they apparently dug what we were doing. And it turned out he and his buddies, they had a rock band too. Ah. And so we talked, and then we hooked up at that point. And then Brian just offered himself as a fill in on any instrument that I would ever need, and which I quickly, I took him up on that.
Right. Right.
And then I booked some shows with his band and mine, and we're just trying to help them out and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then Brian kind of really got really involved with playing in my band, because we played so much in LA. We would play a lot. He calculated one year. It's like, do you realize we played, I don't know, well over 100 shows for a local, LA band? It was, I guess, unusual. But then, he was advised to hang out at the Cinema and just sit in as much as possible. And we also, because you can play so many different instruments and just do that.
Yeah.
And good things will happen.
Right.
So he eventually got folded into Dwight's world, into Dwight's band. And about a year later, the guitar slot opened up. And as opposed to going to like some sort of audition situation or putting the APB out to all guitar players, mm-hmm. I think they were kind of hoping to do something a little more, a little more quietly.
Right.
So they were wrapping up the Three Pairs album. They were in the mixing stages of that.
Okay.
And Brian called. I remember I was serving on jury duty. Oh. And then that day we got out early because we sent a couple of dudes to the chair or something. I don't remember. I can't remember now. But we got home.
It was a rough day.
And, yeah. Well, for them.
For them.
I mean, my parking was free. That was just a really important thing. No, but Brian called and said, hey, man, come down to the studio because Dwight wants to kind of talk to you about filling in for some shows. At the time it was just kind of get us through a month or so like that. But mm-hmm. it turned into the gig. It was great to go down and I had met Dwight, but not really met Dwight, like hi and bye. And we've been introduced mm-hmm. a few times backstage over the years.
Got you.
In LA. Cause he says, we've met before. Apparently we've met before. I said, nothing you'd remember, sort of thing.
Right.
As you don't really play a whole lot. You just kind of talk. You just kind of, we just talked about the music and,
right.
And I let him know that I was familiar with the guitar parts of a large portion of his catalog.
Right.
He was just great. He's just kind of, it's cool. And we'll get you whatever you need. If you don't need, tapes of shows or whatever you need, just mm-hmm. let us know whatever you need to feel comfortable doing the thing and we'll see how it goes. So, it was fantastic. After the first show, he and I were, he was like, good. You took a good swing at it. That's not an easy chair to just jump into.
And you didn't rehearse or?
Oh yeah. I got in one band rehearsal. Gotcha. We kind of just, they set everything up in the studio.
With Dwight or?
Well, yeah, Dwight was in the control room at the studio, still listening to mixes.
Oh, okay.
And so he'd listen in on us, but I got to run through this and I was just more interested really for the experience of working the guitar handoff stuff with the tech.
Right, right.
And also just kind of going through the set list, the certain ins and outs of things. Mm-hmm. Like if the cue is dependent on me, if I start this or I get us out of this, I want to get the flow of that.
Right.
But also I never had a guitar tech before.
Got you.
Which is kind of something I had to learn that.
Yeah.
I had to learn that. And that's a relationship you have to have, and how to have that conversation was I had to learn that. I learned that on this gig. So it's just, you're always learning something. Every day with Dwight's an education. What hasn't this guy come across? He saw this coming. He saw this, whatever the thing is. He saw that coming around the bend.
He
so knew this was going to happen. And it's just like, that's just amazing to watch.
Yeah.
So I did get one rehearsal, but then after that first show, he said something like, I couldn't really hear you a little bit. Were you turned all the way up the whole time? And I said, well, no. And I'm thinking proper country etiquette is, when you were singing, I potted down a little bit.
Right.
And then if it was solo time, I'd turn the guitar up, play it full volume. And then at the end of the solo, pot back down to about 7.
Right.
He's like, what? He goes, no, don't do that. Yeah. Don't ever turn down. And then he pauses. Why would you be tasteful? Don't be tasteful. So the next morning, my wife called. She goes, well, how'd it go? And I said,
right.
He told me to never turn down.
It's something to get used to.
Well, no, but he's like, he took the one neurosis you could possibly have as the lead guitar.
Yeah.
And he just cut it off at the pass.
Right, right.
No, you leave it up all the time.
Yeah.
Because this is also based, how should I say? Look, I never really had my own front of house guy before in any gig. Sha Na doesn't have their own front of house guy. Gotcha. My band certainly. It was
so
like,
how big is the crew? Is there a crew on the Sha Na thing? Or
they had a guy. They had like one guy, Pete, and he
kind
passed,
of a road manager.
And he passed away a few years ago. So I'm assuming they have someone else now. But sometimes band members would fill in, like, you know, the bass player was in charge of stage monitors. He'd get there a little earlier than the others. And so it was kind of a very self contained thing.
Right.
But yeah, the Dwight gigs, like, there's, you know, there's someone handling.
There's people for you.
You've got support.
I remember the first time I had a guitar tech was a High School Musical, and I remember having a conversation because I usually use active pickups.
Okay.
So I'm always concerned in a bar gig about my batteries because I just, they're expensive, you know, and when you're paying four nights, four sets a night, you know, so I always unplug after every set, you know? So I just remember saying to him, you know, the way he had my rig set up, it was like, I don't like having a DI box because if I unplug here, then I got to unplug in two places, you know? And then I was like, I want to save my batteries. And he just looked at me and he's like, I think we can get you some batteries.
It's natural. you know what that story reminds me of? When my wife and I were first dating, I mentioned how, I had to go to Guitar Center to get a glass slide, right? And because the one I had obviously had probably rolled off the amp and shattered into a million pieces on the gig last night. So I need to go get another one. And she said, does that happen a lot? I was like, it happens. You know, they fall, they break, and just go get another one. She says, are they expensive? I was like, not really. And she goes, and you just buy one every time? And I thought, because I'm still thinking like a 13-year-old who can only afford one slide at a time.
Right, right.
It should be like scissors or eyeglasses or tape measures. Just buy like 10 and stash them everywhere. What are you doing?
Yeah. And when you're on a crew like this, like the amount of batteries they go through even in a week is astounding. You know, there's a road case for batteries. You know? Like, you
know? Oh, that's so exciting to me. Though. I love the... just the logistics.
Yeah.
When we did that Eric Church tour back in 2014, fall of 2014, I was enamored with how fast the local and the road crew would work to tear that thing down.
Yeah.
It was incredible. A military experience because you would go behind the curtain because we were playing arenas and you go and Eric's doing like his last song or two. And what the audience doesn't know is that there's this whole staff of crew back there in helmets and pads, and they've got pulleys and ropes, and they have a mission. And just see that potential energy that no one else can see, and like when they get that cue, they're breaking down like it's so impressive.
I know, and they're working all through the night on a big on an arena tour like
Have you seen, like the American, just like everything has a number, everything's got a truck, everything's like that. I'm just so impressed because I'm not
incredible.
The most organized person in the world. So watching that is just, it's inspiring.
Right.
I love watching it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm a sucker for that stuff.
Yeah.
It's real. The first time I got an Anvil case for an amp, back when I was like 20 years old, that was it.
Yeah.
That was it.
Didn't you
feel
big time?
Yes. Look at that. It's this big black thing with like huge metal locks and it has wheels. And are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I've got myself a case here.
I know. I have two, we're sitting in front of my Eden rig and I have road cases for all that stuff stored out there. Haven't used them in years, you know, and I don't need them on the Dwight gig. And I'm like, should I just sell this stuff?
No, just
it's
make
like
a,
the
make,
matter, the pride that it
just make a really large and sad shadow box of something. Just open it up, make a diorama.
Recreate
the Dwight Sage, but in a road case. That'd be kind of a meta thing.
Yeah.
I've got ideas, Eric.
Yeah. No, this is great. This is perfect. Do you know what to do with old CDs? Because I've got a couple of thousand of them.
Well, I could use a coaster for my beer. That's about it.
There's nothing to do. In fact, if anyone's listening and wants to, you know, email me anywhere and tell me what to do with a couple of thousand old CDs.
Do you have a gun? Target practice.
Oh, that's
a
good one.
Pull. There you go. I'm a dive bar
rock star. I have to confess something. I love books, but I don't love reading. And it's been something that I've wrestled with since I was a kid. You know, I can read, I have read books, but they're very time consuming and I've spent most of my time trying to build a music career, which takes a lot of time. But one thing I definitely do a lot of is drive in LA traffic on my way to a gig. And there's a solution that combines those two situations, and that's called Audible.com. Audible has thousands of audiobook titles, and you can listen offline anywhere, anytime. The app is free and can be installed on all smartphones and tablets. And they have just a ton of music-related titles, like All You Need to Know About the Music Business by Donald S. Passman, How Music Works by David Byrne, or Music Production Secrets by Calvin Carter. And you can get a free 30-day trial right now if you visit audibletrial.com/divebarrockstar. That's audibletrial.com/divebarrockstar. I'd like to take a second to thank you for listening to the Dive Bar Rockstar podcast. As a new podcast, getting the word out is a vital part of what it takes to keep the show on the road, or off the road, as the current case may be. If you would like to support the podcast, all you got to do is subscribe wherever you listen. And if you have an extra minute or two, please leave a review. You can also share and follow the podcast on your social media apps. Okay, enough begging. I hope you're having fun. And once again, thank you for listening. You've come out with a new record.
Oh, yeah.
And unfortunately, there's no time to talk about
it. Oh, that's cool.
But thanks for coming.
Oh, check I had it a out. Lovely time. I'll be in the pool.
I'm kidding. I've got all night. That's I have no gigs.
I know.
My schedule is your schedule.
I don't. The Lakers may have clinched the title by now, and I have no idea. I'm sitting here talking.
Did
to
I wreck?
You.
Oh man!
Yeah,
did
thanks.
I
wreck, way did to I go, wreck it? Way to go, Baines.
See, that's just how much not of a sports guy.
But
I am.
You do these at night. Do you always do these at night?
I try to,
because the musicians are kind of awake right around.
Yeah,
here. Yeah.
And it gives me all day to, like, if I can get it into one day, because, you know, I probably cyber stalked you for a good 4 or 5 hours.
But I can only imagine. I mean, there's a guy named David Eugene Edwards. Who has I don't know. I've never listened to his music, but I think, and we don't look
alike.
Oh,
wait, that's not you?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Well, all of this is a waste of time. Do you have a record though, right?
Can
you tell me about it?
I do. So this was supposed to be the second, my follow-up to my debut that came out, I think, during the George W. Bush administration.
Wow. Dang. Well, you know, you took the time to get it right.
I paced myself.
Yeah.
No, I made it, only a couple of years after the first one, but
oh, interesting.
But things had changed by then. I think by the time we recorded, and that was the thing, I recorded it with the band I had. The first album I did was essentially, it was me and the drummer, and I just kind of played, sang everything, you know,
right,
done on a budget sort of stuff,
mm-hmm.
and done on a 1-inch tape machine, sort of on a 16-track 1-inch tape machine. It was great.
Oh, wow, cool.
A lot of fun. It was called My Favorite Revolution. And we played the clubs quite a bit and did a little bit of road work. We gone over to England, played the Cavern Club, or at least where it's now,
wow,
where it now sits. But that was fun. So we kind of just like got some time in a few studios and I wanted to use the band. It was Brian Whelan. It was Mike Sess on drums, Davey Michelle on bass. Who else did we have on there? My friend John Hoskinson, who played rhythm guitar and sang a lot of the harmonies. So we recorded everything, mixed it. The guy Dave Peterson, who produced my first album, he also did this one.
And where did you record it?
Gosh. Well, Dave has his own home studio. A lot of home studios, frankly.
Cool.
For the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It was done. And by then, I guess it was probably 2006, 2007. And I just didn't even know, what is an album?
Yeah.
I was asking this question then. Didn't really have a label, nothing to speak of.
Right.
Didn't have a book. I had a booking agency, but they were waiting for, like, well, when you get your top 20 single,
right,
we'll book you.
Right.
So I had a day-to-day manager, but he was just trying to hustle as hard as he could, but it just wasn't him. And frankly, the style of music wasn't really hitting big anyway. So I wasn't really, and I was about to become a father. And just the gambles the risks you have to take to bet on yourself at that point.
Right. Right.
Those just were no longer responsible risks to take.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I just sort of stopped gigging. I stopped booking gigs, and, the momentum of putting this thing out kind of went with it. It's like, I just didn't put it out. There's no other way to put it. It's my energy to put it out and everything that would require to follow up putting that thing out at that time.
Yeah.
Just wasn't there. I just didn't feel all the support that I really needed just wasn't there.
Right.
And ultimately it falls to me that I wasn't going to do all that work myself.
Yeah.
So,
right. And it's a lot.
And I'll just, like, and, totally, but like I said, I'll raise my hand and say, look, this was my call. Mm-hmm. Ultimately mm-hmm. my decision. So no regret. And honestly, that's the weird thing. Really not any regrets. The only regret I had is that the men and women on this record, they worked hard.
Right.
They worked hard. They really cared. You know, there was no dough in it, mm-hmm. you know, and, mm-hmm. and they played, like, especially Davey, the bass player. He, listening to these tracks again before I put them out, I was like, I remember at the time that he would come in and he'd play, and I'd listen back and think, I know he's just playing bass, but it sounds like he knows what this song's about much more than I do. I wrote it and I'm singing it, and he seems to understand what's happening so much more than I do.
Well, that's
his bass playing just breaks my heart, you know. And then it just kind of got to a point where only every now and then someone would ask, hey, you ever gonna put out another record? And those questions kind of died down. Mm-hmm. Then the Dwight gig probably put my profile back up on some level. It's bound to. Mm-hmm. I think people went back and found the first records. Well, this was unexpected. This is kind of, and because, you know, it's very pop rock.
Right.
I don't know how else to, other than just it's kind of fits into, I mean, I would actually, what does that sound like to you? And I'm not begging for comp. I'm just saying, like, interested, like, how would you describe this?
Right. Because it's very vintage, like retro, you know, it's I don't want to say dated because I don't think that's it, but it's you know, it's very Elvis Costello, I don't know, Fountains of Wayne.
That was probably the one act that took that type of thing as mm-hmm. far as you could at that time.
Right.
They really were. That was like, I think that was the height of that kind of that type of pop craft.
So there's very familiar noises coming out,
right.
You know, and the guitar sounds and all that mm-hmm. stuff, which is kind of cool because you for me it's like I immediately, oh, okay, I'm listening to this. This is what it is, mm-hmm. and you kind of can really focus in on the lyrics at that point in the song mm-hmm. because you're not so. And I mean that in a good way.
No, yeah, you're not distracted.
You're not analyzing like. What is that? How did that happen? And what is mm-hmm. What is this even?
Right.
You
right.
just know what it is. Mm-hmm. It's a very familiar, I would probably say Americana, like a little, maybe more hard rocking Americana.
Yeah. There's always a touch of that. And I think anything even if I set out to write like a whatever type song, I think there's something about the tone of it. It's always going to have that roots thing.
Yeah.
Just played country for so long and played rockabilly for so long. And,
right.
And for whatever reason, that's just
there. But I also hear the birds and that's sort of, you know, where rock gets thrown into all that. Mm-hmm. And then something, you know, there's a modern twist to it.
Right. So, so now with the quarantine, mm-hmm. It just seemed like for whatever reason, it seemed like, I think this is, I'm just going to put it out there and not in any big splash way. I'm not going to tour. I'm not even going to do local club gigs. There's no release party. That's like that. Not even worried about that. It's just about putting that material out there.
Yeah.
And whoever finds it the way they find it. Great. Or it's just a little something extra to listen to in everyone's downtime.
Right.
But it certainly, it certainly doesn't interrupt, my path with Dwight or with anything else I'm doing or the Fender stuff I'm doing. Like it doesn't,
you're not about to get in a van with your buddies and tour for a year.
No one is. Exactly. Oh my God. Those are the days, man. Being in the van with Russell. That was a trip. We had a van that we called Vanosaurus Rex. It was this big green thing. And I remember the first time I got it, I opened the passenger door and this like 3.5 foot leg bone rolled out of it. And I'm still not even remember what animal that was from, but it was from a barbecue of some sort. Like they stopped at a barbecue place in Tucson and Russell had finished it in the van and they just, oh my God, that was so much fun.
Gosh.
That band was so much fun. Oh Jesus, Russell, man, that guy, Russell Scott.
Wow.
He plays upright bass and sings.
Oh, okay.
And he, truly a legend.
Mm.
When I met him, it was in the mid 90s. And, you know, I'd heard a board tape of him. I played at the Palomino, actually, with Fascon.
Wow.
We played on the last days of the Palomino.
Wow.
And we were setting up, and this music was playing overhead. And I couldn't tell. I couldn't tell if it was a man or woman singing. I couldn't tell you what decade this thing was made. Like, is this in the 40s, 60s, 50s? What is this? It's four songs. Wow. And I was just captivated. So I asked the sound guy, I said, what is this? It was Russell Scott and his Red Hots. And my brain, that nerd thing, I'm trying
right.
to think, I'm going through like my final place. Like, no, I don't. Like, when was that? And he looks at me kind of, he's like, last night here. Like, it was just a board tape from the night before.
Wow. That's funny.
So he made a copy of it for me, a cassette copy, you know, says, don't tell anyone I did this, but here you go.
Right.
And I was obsessed over it.
Wow.
And then I mentioned it to Buzz, the Heart with Lincoln guys. And they're like, oh yeah, Russell. And they're like, wow, that's LA rockabilly. And that's like the cream of the crop. Like that's, and then I finally met Russell at a club one night at a Hot Rod Lincoln gig, and Russell was going to sit in and play bass. And Buzz said, hey, I think Gene would really like to play with you though. So I got on stage and Russell says, well, what do you know? And Russell has this really high tenor, and really, he would smoke clove cigarettes. So it's a real raspy high tenor voice.
Right.
Oh, what do you know? And I named like the three or four songs from that board tape.
Wow.
And he goes, oh, well, we kind of do it different. I said, no, I know your version. I'm good.
Don't ask me why.
Including Fly Me to the Moon.
Wow.
They did Fly Me to the Moon as a three piece.
Oh, that's cool.
And so we did that. We did Lotta Lovin' by Gene Vincent. And we did an old mariachi tune, but a Western swing band version of El Rancho Grande. Oh. As obscure as it was going to get. And right, then they figured out a three piece version of it. And I played that. And he was kind of looking like, what's going on? So I spilled the beans about the board tape. So and he wasn't that happy about somebody dubbing the tape. He was happy that I knew
right.
the parts. And then like a year or two later, he needed a guitar player. And his guitar player at the time was a guy, Eddie Perez, who was going to move to Nashville. And then 17, I think it was like 17 years later, Eddie Perez was parting with Dwight. And so twice in my life, I followed in his wake. Yeah, just one of those things.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you replaced Eddie and you're playing Pete Anderson's parts. I mean, a lot of them, you know, was that intimidating at first? Like you did you feel like you had big shoes to fill? I mean, especially with the Pete Anderson stuff, he's such a unique guitar player.
You know what it is? I'm sorry to cut you off, but yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. It's Pete.
Pete also, by the way, producing the records, you know, he's a big influence on the whole sound of what
it's
you're
almost,
doing.
It's almost just having the guitar position with Dwight. That's probably the intimidating thing.
Yes.
Cause there's only a few guys that have had that position.
Right.
Really for, you know, cause I remember when I was the Tonight Show, I assume Dwight Yoakam's would be on and Pete wasn't there. Some other guy.
Gotcha.
And as a guitar player, it's like, who is that guy? I mean, not in a negative way. It's like, Oh my God, who's this guy? And you kind of like, he must be good because he's there.
Right.
And so what's really been great though, is that obviously with the back catalog of Dwight's stuff, I just personally have my own preciousness about those parts. I just remember sitting on the edge of my bed, learning them probably mostly incorrectly, but giving it a shot. And how much I was learning. And so there's certain parts of those that I want to protect. And I use that word very carefully because they're not my parts. But I also realize like we're part of a generation of live musicians that have this relationship with a catalog. Mm-hmm. We're not the original guy.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to serve that because there's an audience that has a relationship with these parts and these tunes.
Right.
And our job is to really protect that relationship and not be a wrecking ball to it.
Right.
Respect for the artists that you're with, but also that relationship that audience has with the artist and that artist made that relationship and he's cultivated that thing or he or she has cultivated that relationship for a very long time. And they work 24/7 to maintain that relationship. To maintain a career is a thing.
Yeah.
And so
it's generally not an accident.
I'll be damned if this goofball comes over and just like screws up guitar parts all the time and just like, God damn, man, what was, you know, that didn't, I don't know what was going on. Right. So I don't want that to be on my shoulders.
Right.
And there's just a lot of us out there because of the casino world and all those live gigs that showed up all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about, you know, the guys that are with Journey or with any of those catalog acts, you know, so like you got to come in and learn. And this guy, Brian Head, great drummer. Oh, I just did my first. I'm so excited. I finally did it. I'm a guest on your podcast. And I mentioned another musician and they were amazing music. Phenomenal. Now I'm like every other guest on your show now.
Oh, that's
Brian Head? He's a great drummer. Killer drummer. Yeah. So good.
Yeah.
Great drummer.
We should briefly explain that. You were giving me shit about that.
Oh,
too.
Yeah, I was.
I was like, but that's like, you know, everyone wants to be polite. So I was like,
natural.
Just like, one day I'm just going to be like, you know, blah, 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 blah. Shitty bass player.
Yeah, yeah. Terrible tone.
It's going to come. One of these episodes. You just keep listening.
He had a gig. He's played with Foreigner. He's played with Roger Hodgson from Supertramp. We talk about learning classic parts.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So anyway.
And there's a skill to that.
There is.
That's a thing for sure. And not everybody can do it. Not only playing somebody else's thing, but then doing it four nights a week and making it sound fresh every day like it was your part, you know.
That's
skill in itself, you know.
That's performance. I think that, you know, stage actors would probably just snicker at what you just said, because like, yeah, well,
yeah,
try three acts of a play and saying those words as if they're just occurring to you for the first time, but you do it eight times a week,
right?
That's what's being asked of us, and it's not impossible.
For sure.
Always being
but
asked.
I'm just saying not everybody can do it either, and sometimes sometimes the original artist couldn't do it. You know, there's something that goes against the grain of having to go out there and do it the same every night for some people.
Well,
there's
a
particular type of artist who doesn't want to sing it the same way all the time.
That's
right. And in a way can't.
That's the funny thing about
Dylan. Because they won't.
That's the Dylan thing, right? Where that cracks me up, where I still feel as though I hear people, I remember being, it must have been New Orleans last year, and Jameson and I went out for lunch and we took a Lyft car or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, the driver was asking, well, we're musicians, blah, 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 yeah, concert, blah. And the driver said something about they'd gone to see Bob Dylan last year. And I was like, oh, cool. They're like, no, I didn't recognize anything. And everything was like, since when has Bob Dylan been known?
Yeah, right.
To sound just like the record.
Right.
Like, did you do no research? Not even accidentally know that the man has not sounded like the record.
Right.
Another
guy that we play with a lot with is Willie Nelson. And you listen to him, he's like a jazz player up there, man.
Yeah.
It's different every night and it's whatever he wants. And he just goes. And sometimes I actually kind of feel bad for the band because he's not even going to stay in the right time sometimes. You just follow, you know.
I just giggle.
I know.
I'm sitting there just laughing. I was like, that is.
Well, I can't watch him without grinning from ear to ear constantly anyways, because the man is phenomenal.
Back to the Lester Bangs quote, Willie Nelson, another thing. We will not agree on anything like we agreed on Willie Nelson.
Right.
I think Tom Petty fit that bill.
Yeah.
I think that was the feeling when Petty was like, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
God, we could all like, Petty's cool though, right?
Yeah.
I think Mark Maron had a bit about that in the stand-up. And it was like, yeah, we can agree. I think Dolly Parton is fitting into that.
Yeah,
We just universally agree. Okay, we all like Dolly, right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. This side, that side, drag queen, doesn't matter.
Right.
We all dig Dolly. Okay, fine.
Right. Yeah.
Songwriters, got to respect Dolly. Everyone's got, there's, you know, certain people just kind of feel the thing. And it makes us feel good to talk about them.
Yeah.
You know, there'll be more coming. There'll be more coming somehow.
Yeah. And, you know, whoever we're listening to right now, probably one of those is going to be that.
I hope so.
You know, over time.
Maybe me
we'll
with
see.
This. Old,
I mean,
old record.
I think you're a contender.
No, but so thank you for mentioning it. It's like it's the softest release possible.
Mm-hmm.
Like
because
it's like, well, it's not meant to make a big splash, and it's this really old thing.
Right. But it is. There's some really really cool songs. So
cool.
I mean, I really thought it was it's worth checking out for free on Spotify.
That's right. Exactly. There was a great line. I remember once doing a club gig here in LA, and we had the first CD out. And, you know, in between songs, I mentioned, you know, as you have to, it's like, oh, by the way, on break, if you want to see us, we have, you know, copies of my CD here, and, you know, talk to me if you want to buy one. Mm-hmm. And there's a pause. And then John, my rhythm guitar player, he goes up the mic and goes, or I could just burn one for you.
Oh, man.
And I remember thinking,
yeah,
or that.
Yeah, I know.
Truly.
We're there, aren't we? Yeah. And now we're at the point where
it was 2005.
And now we're at the point where if someone hands me a CD, I'm just like, dude, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to throw it away. I don't even know how to play it. So is it on Spotify? Give me a card that says you're on Spotify. I will go listen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fan, but I don't even, and you know, I I guess in here I have an old laptop. I have a this is my only CD player sitting mm-hmm. right here, you know, but that's just where we're at now, you know. And this is just a digital release, right?
Digital only. Just go to Amazon, iTunes, Spotify. Is there a fourth one? I don't know. And it, just go to the big three.
Yeah.
Search Eugene Edwards, A Week of Sundays, and yeah. hopefully good stuff will happen. You know, not counting on making any money on it or anything right. like that. It's a really good feeling.
It's a great feeling.
It's a no stakes release.
Yeah. I've done it too. Every time I would just give it away and be like, this is my gift to the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I made these songs and you know, it's so much more fun. And then I got rid of more of those CDs by giving them away than trying to sell them anyways. So
yeah, there's kind of like had I made CDs, there'd be like guilt involved. It's like, oh no.
Yeah, yeah. This was years ago, though. I haven't put out a record in years either.
Yeah. But you did your own label. Like, see, that's an ambition. That's swinging for the fences, man.
Yeah. I started my own label in 2009, just as the economy crashed, and no one has any extra cents to buy anything.
Not positive, just the quarantine, the reality of it. And I know that you've addressed it on the past few episodes because it's just kind of this elephant now in terms of gigging.
Right, yeah, yeah.
When did it occur to you that your job was non-essential?
Oh, man. I know. I've never really... This is
when you don't agree.
When it occurred to me that my job might be non-essential was the 9/11, the day of 9/11. Mm. When I was in L.A. and I had just played at the World Trade Center. I used to have jazz shows right in the... Mm-hmm. You know, maybe 8 months before there, I was just standing there. The dressing room was in Building 1, in Tower 1 or whatever. And that was the day that I felt so completely useless. And all I wanted to do was, if I was in New York, I would have been one of those guys heading right toward it. Like, give me a shovel.
Yeah.
Who can I dig out? You know, that was the day that I just started to be like, maybe not the, I mean, I've always just as an artist and a musician, I don't know, you know, as a musician, there's, to me, there was always that insecurity of, it was what I'm doing, especially when they start out in the bars. This is all my bitter 20s. I was just like, all I am is a beer salesman. I wanted to be great. You know, I wanted to be somebody. I thought I had a message for the world and all I do is sell beer. These people don't even, I'm playing Mustang Sally for the 850th time. And tonight I'm with a band that sucked worse than the night before and they still love it. No matter how badly I play Mustang Sally, they still dance and go crazy. And I was just so bitter about that. And I think that was sort of my beginning of knowing that I'm completely non-essential.
That's a great answer. Oh my God.
It's tricky for me. So this COVID thing does not help.
Or also it's like, oh, I've been here.
Yeah.
I've been here.
Oh yeah. 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 Don't worry. We'll be gigging soon. Well, but that's why I made this podcast too, because it's almost in a way an effort to prove that we matter, you know,
and
that we've had these lives that were significant to at least us.
So we're Wynton Marsalis. Yeah. We're trying to preserve, just trying to make sure, you know, this existed. I swear it did.
Exactly.
We need to preserve the fact it existed.
Yeah.
No, it
does. I think this is a more essential thing because somebody coming up might, you know, benefit from it. And I just have said in the past, like, as I used to teach as well, coming out of high school, and I really loved it. And I didn't know, I had to make a choice whether to try to make it or to be a teacher, you know? And I'm to this day not sure which one,
still not.
If I made the right choice, because I've stood on stage in front of 80,000 people, played my bass, heard my name over the PA, people screamed, 80,000 people screaming at me. Mm-hmm. And it never felt as good as the second I saw a student go, oh, I get it.
Mm.
You know, that like feels like you changed the world. Making 85 people scream for a second, I might have made them forget about things for a minute, but after the show's done, they get to go back to whatever life and troubles and worries that they have. Mm-hmm. How significant, maybe I've given them a story to tell, you know, like it's always with me how non-essential I might be. I'm not sure yet. I'm agnostic about it.
Right, you don't know. okay, that's a take, I suppose. But we don't know, you know, you don't know in that arena of 80,000 people, you don't know who you touched. My first concert was just flat out cathartic. Like maybe I still would have become a musician, you know, odds are, sure. Mm-hmm. I had encouragement in the home for sure, you know, but why I wanted to do it was defined on that night. And I was 7 years old.
Wow.
And yeah, I was one of I don't know how many people in that, maybe 20, 30,000 people. And I don't know if those people on that stage that night knew.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Wednesday night on their itinerary.
Right.
But they flat out changed my life.
Wow.
There's just nowhere to put it. So you don't know. Yep. Out of those 80,000, odds are you did something really profound for some, as profound as the student that where something clicked. Now the difference is you watched the student one-on-one. That moment was slowed down for you. You mm-hmm. could take it in, recognize it, take it in whole.
Right.
And you just don't get that same opportunity with that one person out of 80,000.
Right. Yeah. So. Well, you've brightened up my day.
That's why I'm here.
No, I love that. It's totally true. And but I feel like, I mean, do you have any of that? Do you question those kind of things? Like for me, that's just kind of like my life's question. I guess.
Have more complexes than an Olympic venue. Yeah. The do I matter? I don't wonder about that because it doesn't matter either way.
Well,
I'm here. And that's great. So the idea is, but be a service to others. Obviously having a family, but honestly, like just the intrinsic right. value of when we get out of the passenger van, you know, at the hotel or at the venue, just kind of offer to grab someone's bag for them, which, right. you know, on the road that will, you surprise a bandmate with that one. Like, what are you going to, yeah. put something in it? What are you gonna do? What are you doing in my bag? I'm just helping right. you.
Yeah.
And just go the other way.
Yeah. Right.
And I do know that, you know, now that I'm teaching private lessons on mastery, look it up.
I've got it on the list here. Oh, we're going to get to that eventually. It'll be about 3 hours from now.
That's right. You knew this was going to happen.
I knew it. And you know what? I still made like 5.5 pages of notes knowing that I'm not going to need any of this stuff.
Fill this in.
But it's awesome. Don't get me wrong. No, I'm so happy to talk to you. This is absolutely,
it's like being on the bus again.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but the teaching lesson is great because frankly, sometimes I'm just maybe a week or two ahead of the student anyway, in terms of like, well, I know where they are now. I know what I've assigned.
Right.
And assuming they knock that out, what's next for them?
Right.
And that's a lovely challenge. And in fact, next week's Fender Play Live episode, instead of having a guest on that's a spotlight artist sort of thing, or as opposed to talk about a particular lesson that's on the Fender site, it's going to be a panel of three of us talking about essentially like, why shouldn't you quit guitar?
Right. Oh, interesting.
And there's three main stumbling blocks, I think. There's people, it's all perception. They feel like they don't have enough time.
Mm-hmm.
They feel they don't have an inherent musical talent. Like, I just lack talent. I'm not musical. My fingers won't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's this sort of plateau, like they learned all their first position chords and they don't know where to go from there. It's like, I do this and then that's all I know and that's it. I'm done. So the idea is how to encourage people to get past that.
Mm-hmm.
How to budget time. That's a skill. That's a thing. Also the people feeling they're not talented. And I was like, that might be true.
Right.
I mean, you may not come out of the womb the way Eddie Van Halen did. That's right. just, yes, there are going to be those that just can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But since neither you or I are Stevie Wonder, we're going to have to work.
Right.
We're going to have to work.
Yeah.
And then the third thing that wrote, like not knowing where to go beyond this, that's usually the student I get. I get a little, like, well, I've been a rhythm player for a while. I kind of want to, you know, kind of play some leads or sometimes just, I want to be able to go up beyond the fifth fret.
Like, right.
There's just no man's land. I don't know what's going on up there.
Mm-hmm.
And to help them just discover more of that is, I know what you mean. It's like, it's really, really wonderful. And I usually never had time for teaching or I felt like, well, I don't have a background as a teacher, so I don't know how I'm going to do that. But if someone says, well, just show me, like, how did you come up with this? Or how is that play? Like, well, I can answer that.
Right.
And then once you answer that, now it's like, oh, you know what? You should also know this.
Right.
And if you're into that, you should probably listen to this and study this. And, And so, yeah, I'm really enjoying that. Yeah. I'm really enjoying the teaching. I love doing the Fender show, the broadcast.
And tell me more about the Fender playbook. Well, first of all, where's the teaching? You're doing that online.
That's online. You can book a lesson with me through the platform. It was called Live Lessons Masters, but they've changed the name to Mastery.
Mastery Live.
And because you can... .com. Yes, you can take lessons with chefs and yoga instructors. And
oh, got you.
It's a whole thing that they started this year. Mm-hmm. And so that's the private lessons that I'll do. And then with Fender, I guess I've developed a relationship with them over the past couple of years. I started to demonstrate a lot of the guitars and amps in their videos, their marketing videos, which was great. A lot of fun. And then they every Wednesday do a live show that's broadcast on YouTube and Facebook. And it's called Fender Play Live. And every Wednesday afternoon, it's usually, we try to do about a half hour. Mm-hmm. And of course, Fender Play is the online lesson program that they have. And they just keep adding more songs and more skills and more things. Cool. And now the new thing is during this time, they have a contract with LAUSD. So if a kid wants to learn to play ukulele or bass or guitar, they have free access to Fender.
Oh, that's amazing.
The site. And Fender will, they'll make sure that the kid has an instrument in their hands as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So,
that's great.
So now we've got to add more lessons there. So when you go to the site, there's a lot of stuff up there you can learn. I mean, it's like 2-minute skill lessons. Again, that's the time thing. You can just learn this little thing.
Yeah.
Anywhere from how to make a C chord to how to play Fast As You by Dwight Yoakam. I mean, there's heavy metal stuff and there's a lot of Billie Eilish stuff on there now.
That's cool.
They even have how to play like 7 Billie Eilish tunes on ukulele.
Oh,
so they've even
kind
of made it where like if you're first time, you know, if you don't even played an instrument before, ukulele, small, it's cheap, it's easy on the fingers. But here's some chords and you'll sing along and before you know it, you can actually perform a Billie Eilish tune. It's very encouraging.
Yeah.
So the Fender show is usually just trying to highlight, it's to promote the online lesson course, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have guests. It's done remotely. We've had amazing player named Justice West. Killer player. Amazing musician. But he did it from his house in Kansas City. You know, now in this era, we can have anybody on, no matter where they live.
Yeah. Well, man, this has been just nothing but awesome.
This has been a slice of heaven.
I wanted to talk more about your record, but let's at least just mention one song so I can play it during the podcast.
Are we going
to
throw to a song?
Well, first of all, I wanted to talk about the fact that what I love about listening to this record is that it sounds like a record. It feels like it's an album. It's a collection that goes together. And I love how you reprise the title track in an acoustic way. And and I'm listening down and you get to My Dark Side. Now you know My Dark Side now. Isn't that the lyric?
Mm-hmm.
And it's right in a spot where it's like you're singing to me. Because of all the songs previous, they're sort of all sort of breaking down all your, you know, it seems to me, breaking down some of your neuroses.
Right. It was.
And by the time you get to the, now you know my, it's just
and
brilliantly
now you know
placed.
This. So Dave Peterson did the sequencing. He's very good about sequencing. My Dark Side was based on the one line that I got from a movie.
Oh.
A beautiful Spanish, not a horror film, more like a creepy movie. The Orphanage, or Orfanato, I guess would be the...
Oh.
And Guillermo del Toro was a producer on it. And a medium comes to this abandoned orphanage because there's ghosts there, right? And the medium, she's played by Charlie Chaplin's daughter, Una, actually.
Hmm.
And you got to see this movie. It's so damn good. Because when we first see her from behind, the way she's framed and filmed her silhouette, she's actually... It's a reference to Charlie Chaplin's Little Tramp character. If you look close, it's her. And she says to the main character, when they're talking about perceptions of ghosts and hauntings and memories, she says, seeing's not believing. It's the other way around.
Mm.
And I just love the writing of that line.
Yeah.
And I thought, and of course we're talking about our grip on reality is really why that line is in the movie. And then I just decided, and with this album, as opposed to the first one, I think I wanted more angles. I wanted more kind of despicable characters and thoughts.
Mm.
And, you know, and they all have to be, they're not all me, but they're all kind of angles of things I've heard. I thought, well, you know, this isn't nobody looking at this. And with that, now, you know, My Dark Side thing, it's probably just an aspect of, you said something actually.
Uh-oh.
So now you can decide.
I tend to say things.
You said something about, like, at the beginning of a relationship, sometimes you get all your negative. You pretty much spill it all very early. And
yes.
then it's like, okay. At this point, if you still want to hang around,
yeah,
your call.
Yeah.
But there's no more surprises.
My wife can attest to that.
I think it was probably that was the relationship that it was. Yeah. That you were talking about. And I thought this was really funny. And I think this song kind of is about that. It's kind of like, look, you knew going into this.
Right.
And so I kind of wanted to have that. It's kind of where the tempo is what it is.
Because
I kind of want it to be a, not creepy necessarily, but I wanted everything to really slow down.
Yeah.
Really slow down and kind of, and also the guitar solo at the end. I use the very first electric guitar I ever got. My dad bought for me. It's an 86 Fender Squire Tele.
I have one hanging on my wall.
With some humbucker. It's a Firebird humbucker in the neck position for you guitar players out there. But that's what you're hearing. But it was kind of nice to play that guitar on a track. So, yeah. And the band, I thought the band played beautifully on it too.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Thanks.
Yeah, that line, I've still been thinking about that line and what exactly that means. And that's what's good about it.
Yeah, it's an evocative thing to say. An evocative thing to say.
It's like the other way around. Ooh, it's going to take me a while. We'll get you back on the show once I figured it out.
Yeah.
And you know what I was going to say about Irregular Heartbeat, which is another awesome, just lyrically, it's really hilarious.
This is how old that song is. Mm. I was on the road with Sean and I. I remember being in Florida, stepping out of the shower, and the news was still on, and which seemed to happen every 3 months. Vice President Dick Cheney was rushed to the hospital with an irregular heartbeat.
Oh.
I thought, a what? Oh, that's just too obvious, isn't it?
Right.
And this is also at a time where a politician or a celebrity, somebody would be caught doing something awful.
Mm-hmm.
And as the public shaming would go into gear, the said person would usually check into a rehab of some sort. And then the joke would be like, I don't think there's a rehab for the thing you just pulled. You know, like we just kind of had this. Like the rehab move was like this scapegoat publicist move sort of thing.
Right.
So the jokes, I mean, the song is supposed to be somewhat of a dark joke on that moment. And I'm not even judging anyone on either side of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I just thought the character in the song clearly has a problem with fidelity and he blames it on a medical problem.
Right.
I have an irregular heartbeat.
Right.
That's the gag of that song.
Yeah. Well, it struck me, and it's so weird now that I should have asked you this before, but you wrote all these songs before you had the Dwight gig. That song sounded very Dwight Yoakam to me. Like the way that the lyrics kind of lay out and just the irregular heart. He does a lot of sort of play on heart, you know, and heart that you own. And
Right. Yeah. It's so funny. I didn't, well, you know, like it'd be silly to deny the fact that Dwight, you know, has had an influence on me before I even got the gig.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. He does. He writes about the heart. I love song titles too, that work in two ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the irregular heartbeat thing is just one of those things where it's a phrase that exists. And I was just surprised it had not been put into a romantic or anti-romantic mode.
Right.
You know?
Right.
There was also, we were trying, I remember rhythmically, I don't know if we pulled it off. We were trying to get a weird, awkward half swing that had, like the Doors always had this weird, it's not quite shuffling, it's not quite swinging, something. It's an awkward thing that I always thought was elusive, but when done right was magical. The Pretenders sometimes kind of got near it. We got pretty close, but it was it took minutes to write that one though.
Yeah.
You know, you love those songs.
Yeah.
The melody, everything just falls together.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you finish it and think, I better double check this title.
Right, right.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Irregular heartbeat. Wants what it can have. Be careful if we meet. It's all good till it goes bad. And I know if it's slow.
And another one I thought was really lyrically cool, and I'm not sure that I get it, but so I want to talk to you about it. I think I don't know, but Shake and Shiver. It seemed it's sort of the passing of time a little bit in a relationship, if I got it right.
You know, I don't think there's a right way or wrong way. This is where it's art and it's subjective, mm-hmm. and you got it. I think originally I just wanted to make something that was so undeniably like XTC style pop, mm-hmm. where there's no caveat. There's no scapegoat in terms of its melody or even lyrically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it's hard if you're writing a romantic song, for instance, a love song. I have the tendency to, I'm always looking for like some sort of escape clause in the third verse.
Mm.
Like this has all been one direction with no conditions.
Mm.
Maybe I should put a doubt line somewhere in there just so it's balanced out.
Right.
So I wanted to challenge myself to write one that has none of that doubt.
Right.
Well, it was inspired by when we got married, like 20 years ago, we ran off to Belize because he didn't need a blood test. And we were going to elope, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as a hurricane is now hitting the Gulf, a hurricane, of course, came and hit Belize.
Oh, my gosh.
A Category 5 hurricane.
This is 20 years ago yesterday, right?
That's right. Hurricane Keith comes by. It's a Category 5. And we were in a shelter for about 36 hours on this little island. A little island. Like, they don't have cars on this island.
Mm-hmm.
So we got through that. We got past that. The Shake and Shiver thing was based on, you know, because we were sitting in the shelter was a schoolhouse, a two-room schoolhouse. And so mm-hmm. the only furniture in there were school desks.
Wow.
So I remember my wife was kind of trying to sleep. She was on my lap. She's kind of like seated, but kind of turned over on my lap, and water's coming through the quote unquote windows, because they don't have glass windows there. It's just like
Whoa.
A plastic sheet, and water's mm-hmm. coming through that onto my back. And I realized I thought that was rain that was blowing sideways. And then we realized that that's actually ocean water going Whoa. Over us.
Oh my God.
Yeah. A lot of fun.
Wow.
And so that's the Shake and Shiver. And I think there's maybe references to storms. There's a
yes.
weather. So
yeah,
that's that.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to take that moment and utilize that as a romantic song. Yes, time passes. There is an all things must pass sort of moment. And
right.
the idea is, as time passes, will you and I still be together?
Like, right.
you know,
right.
so many storms happen.
Yeah.
And we just don't know.
Yeah.
We just don't know. So, and that's also part of the gratitude of not knowing what happens to us tomorrow.
Right.
We don't know what happens to us when we die. And how do we take those uncertainties and turn them into gratitudes of the now?
Right.
That's kind of, so yes, you're right. I think you're right. There probably is, I think I was trying to address time, but also let's cherish this because we don't know about the future and
yeah.
all of that. And also just, and all just playing on the memory of that, of the hurricane.
Wow. That's amazing. So, well, that changes it all up a little bit because it starts out with, you love it when we shake and shiver.
Right.
And then it's like,
and now you, we never
and
shake and
shiver.
And then
you ride out on, we never shake and shiver.
Right, because the storm has passed.
And it's almost, but it's also kind of made me think of like, the honeymoon's over and now, you know, that initial like mm-hmm. infatuated feeling of everything's amazing is now turned into
complacency.
Thank God we don't shake and shiver, because maybe not complacency, no, maybe, no. Oh, well, don't let me
that.
Tell you what your,
no, no,
let me
I
tell
don't
you
know.
What your song is about.
I'm
or
open.
Like, you know, now we don't shake and shiver because we're just, it's solid now. You
That's
know,
right.
you don't need those. You
Again,
know.
I'm always trying to get it both ways in
yeah.
a song. I'm
right,
always trying
right,
to get
right.
it both ways. And yeah. and that's, you know, and it's a shame because sometimes you're like, look, just get it one way and then write a second song. Would you get it the other way?
No.
No? All right.
Well, I love it because it goes somewhere.
Hopefully.
You know, it has, and it doesn't get boring. I love also just musically too, how it's kind of always... That's the one that's
Shifting
always changing keys,
keys yeah.
and it's so cool. And then you actually modulate at the end,
mm-hmm.
like kind of legitly. It's pretty cool.
You're
smart.
Flirting with key change the whole thing. And then at the end, we're like, okay, this is a proper.
But it also gives you this weirdly unstable thing and you're going through a storm and it's
you see what I did there?
You're brilliant,
I'm
man.
Painting
Who
a picture.
Knew?
I'm painting a picture over here.
Well, anyways, cool. Cool tune.
Thank you.
Shake and shiver.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, Eric.
This has been unbelievably cool. Let's just quit now.
When
and
do we
drink
start the interview?
Beers. Oh. Yeah. I think that was a good rehearsal. Let's get the take now. Okay. No, it's really, I mean, we get to talk all the time on the road, and it's, you know, it's another skill too, I think, or not, maybe not skill, but it's just another asset to have as a road musician to be able to hold a conversation, because we do a lot of being together, you know, in between stuff and 24/7 buses. And
I don't know if I've heard anyone specifically say this on this show. I guess I assume it has been said, but as you know, on this level of being a working musician, working on a national level, I guess, is that kind of a fair way to put it in terms of most of your guests? Yeah.
Yeah.
Your technical ability as a musician on whatever your instrument is, there's a general minimum that you have to have, a proficiency level. And like you said, the ability to learn parts and interpret them and make them sound as fresh as the day they were recorded. Those are specific skills.
Right.
But I don't know in the end if that's really, it's so important, but is it as important as the hang?
Right. Yeah. No, it comes up a lot. It comes up a lot. And I think that's absolutely.
It does come up on the show, right? It's like, if you're recommending someone or you're referring someone, I mean, I know on your show, you talk, there's a lot of talk about it's all referrals.
Yeah.
Right? Well, yeah. I mean, just, there's not a lot of audition stories on your podcast.
That's very true.
And there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability to hang, the ability to converse, and it really is like, can I live with you for 2 weeks?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, are you that person? Do you understand space and stuff? And, I remember thinking, and I bought this book. we were, I don't know where we were. I can see the gig, but I don't know where we were. Anyway, I walked to Target and they had the Cards Against Humanity.
Oh yes.
Like on the sale rack, like on and I thought, I've always heard tell of this thing. And it seems as though maybe this should be on the bus as to pass time. It seems as though there's a brutal humor, time passing. I'll get, so I grabbed it, right?
Right.
So I take it to and we get dropped off the venue, and I take it out because I want to put it in Big Blue, right?
Yeah. Which is our wardrobe case.
Yeah.
For those of you that aren't on our tour.
Inside ball. So, and I said, oh, look what I got. And I show it to our road manager and Jameson, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just great.
Jameson Hollister, amazing utility player.
Amazing musician, incredible player. And I hold this Cards of Humanity, and James was like, oh, that's awesome. And I said, well, yeah, I've never played this before. He says, you've never played it? Oh, this game is totally you. And I'm looking at the box and I hold it up and it says Cards Against Humanity, a card game for horrible people. I thought, oh.
Oh man.
Thank you.
Oh man. Well, Eugene Edwards, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm going out on that
perfect
one.
for Cards Against Humanity. Oh man. Well, thanks anyways. I mean, thanks again for coming on the show. It was so perfect. And
I'm so excited for you. The show, of course. I'm a big fan.
Well,
and also
thank you.
Having you in my world has been so great. And yes, passing a time, sharing space, sharing gig, all that. You've been a positive thing in my life, and I'm really grateful. Oh. I'm really excited about this show. And you were talking about when you're first starting it up, and I thought this is exactly it. And I think your head was on straight about all your concerns. You had all the right questions.
Yeah, you were kind of my mentor in this. I mean, you were. Like, I called you because you have a podcast as well. Mm-hmm. We didn't get to talk about
That's
either.
Fun.
But I'll put a link on the thing so that everybody knows
they can go back.
Where to find you and check out your podcast, because it's really cool.
But I knew
that you were my closest person I know has a podcast, so I called you a lot.
And frankly, but just, I remember thinking, because you're asking the questions you're asking, you're going to be fine. Like, I know you don't know the answers, but the fact that those are your concerns,
right.
I know this is going to work. You had all the right questions. And then clearly you did the right research. And I was so happy that first episode I heard, and like the format was so clear. Again, you know, like you said about my tunes, it was like, I did not have to guess what this is.
Right. Right.
Because your show from the get go, it knew what it was.
Right.
And I felt like after the first episode, I thought, I know exactly, I can trust this show.
Right.
And in a world of a lot of podcasts, that's huge. That's a big deal. Yeah. So 2.5 hours, not bad.
We've done it. You broke the record.
Cha-ching!
I think he might have come in with a goal to break that record. But he did, and good for him. It was interesting when he was talking about working with older people, because it reminded me that back in the day when I was younger, I used to have three rules to work with a band. The first one was the whole band had to rely on music for their living. So couldn't have day jobs or alternatives, because that ensured that we were going to work. And also they had to have houses and families, you know, they had to need to work. And the other thing that I always had was, I'm not here to make friends. Like if these guys end up being my friends, great, but that's not my main goal. My main goal is to work. And I think the reason I had to have that last rule is because you're going to end up working with older people if those are your requirements and your rules. And so you're probably not going to be meeting people that you're going to, you know, immediately relate to. So I needed to take the pressure. I just needed to take that off the table, you know. And it also struck me listening to that story, how much we put ourselves through just to play music. And when he was talking about reading a book on stage and stuff, it was like, that was so awkward and so weird. But that's how compelled he was to play music and to do this for a living. And I think it's a good mental test for people who are just trying to decide whether to make a go of being a musician for a living. Like if you feel like you can live through the most awkward moments that you could ever imagine and you still want to go up and do it, then maybe this is a living for you, because it can get weird. The Lester Bangs quote that he was referring to is, quote, "I can guarantee you one thing, we will never agree on anything as we agreed on Elvis," unquote. And Lester Bangs was a music journalist. He died in 1982, but he used to write for Rolling Stone and Cream magazine. And really great rabbit hole to go down sometime if you're on a bus and need something to read. John Bauman, Bowser, as he was called in Sha Na Na, did go to Juilliard, started there when he was 12. And I was actually at Berkeley right before Eugene was. Now, when I did all the math, I was there. My first semester was the winter of 91. His first semester was the fall of 91. So completely unimportant, but just in the spirit of correcting myself, then there you have it. So I hope you had a good time, and we'll talk to you next time. I'm a dive bar
rock star. Wow, you've made it to the end. I'm hoping it's because you completely enjoyed yourself and are now filled with knowledge and inspiration to move forward with your dreams. If that is the case and you would like to stay informed of new episodes, live events, and general news, please go to divebarrockstar.com and sign up for the mailing list. If you have any questions, comments, corrections, or complaints about anything you hear on the show, please email me at fanmail@divebarrockstar.com and you may even end up on the show. We at the Dive Bar Rockstar podcast, with all of our hearts, thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about dreams.